From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The White House and the congressional negotiators have lowered the stimulus plan's price tag, reaching a compromise that could put the bill up for a vote by the end of the week. NPR's congressional correspondent Andrea Seabrook joins me now from the Capitol. Hello, Andrea.
Hi there.
So Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said that the differences were resolved between the two versions of the package with a lot of, quote, intense give and take. Tell us what it looks like now, the package that is, and where does it go today?
Well, it looks like this. The top line, the number that it will cost to the U.S. Treasury in both spending and lost revenue from tax cuts is $789.5 billion. Call it $790 billion. That, in fact, and not coincidentally, is the number that the three Republicans that are voting for this bill on the Senate side said that they could vote for and no more. So there was sort of a top line put there. It breaks down into about 35% tax cuts, 65% spending. It has an individual tax cut that for working families that Democrats say will go for to 95% of working Americans. That's $400 for each individual, $800 for couples. It gives about $44 billion to states who are hurting in terms of Medicaid and all sorts of spending on the local level. And it's just chock full of stuff here. It's hard to sort of round out what's actually in it. As far as what's happening today, believe it or not, staff members are actually writing the bill today. This bill has not been filed, a procedural thing that has to happen here in order for it actually to be considered on the House or Senate floors, and it hasn't been yet, so there are people actually still getting this stuff down into language.
Now, yesterday, President Obama visited one of those so-called shovel-ready projects in Virginia, a road under construction. He also visited a Caterpillar plant. Presumably, Andrea, all of this is part of his effort to lobby for bipartisan support of this bill, and the support of the three Senate Republicans that you mentioned was crucial to it. So far, that's not really bipartisan in the truest sense, though, is it?
Well, it depends on how you look at things. And of course, there are a lot of political calculations happening here. I do believe when this comes to the House floor, the final version, that it will get some Republican support. Not a whole lot, but I am hearing from Republican members that a few plan to vote for it. So there will probably be more calls of this as a bipartisan bill. In the Senate, it couldn't even pass without some Republicans. And in fact, because of those three Republicans, the size of this bill is smaller than either the House or the Senate voted for. And of course, President Obama has also been stumping out on the campaign trail, it almost seems like, with Florida's Republican Governor Charlie Crist and other people, other Republican governors who are also hurting. So there is some claim of bipartisanship here that I think can be made honestly.
My last question, and really briefly, is this. It would seem this would be a major legislative victory for the new president coming on the timetable that he presented.
Yes, absolutely. I think this will absolutely be called a huge victory for this new president. I don't think anybody thinks, neither here on Capitol Hill or over at the White House, that this is what anyone wanted to be the big victory of a new president. I think most people around here are saying, oh boy, we wish we could have, done something more hopeful, worked on some of the campaign trail promises, health care, education and so on. But this is what needs to happen now by most people's estimation. And therefore, the president called for it. He pushed for it. He pushed hard for it. And getting it done within the first couple of weeks, 3 weeks of being in office, I think is a big coup.
Andrea, thank you.
My pleasure.
That was NPR's congressional correspondent Andrea Seabrook. She joined us from the Capitol. For a bit more analysis on the stimulus package agreement, we turn now to author and economist Dr. Julianne Malvo. Dr. Malvo, welcome back.
Thank you, Tony.
Many Republicans are calling the stimulus plan bloated, while some Democrats think it doesn't go far enough. Let's talk about the balance. And the two questions I have for you to begin with are, does this package hit the right balance, and how long will it take to know if this balance is actually going to work?
Well, Tony, I line up with the people who think that the stimulus package is not large enough. Obviously, someone said once no one should ever have to watch either legislation or sausage being made because the process is often repugnant. And I think that you can really see that this legislation had a lot of hands in it. As the correspondent said, the details of it are really just being written now. So there are things that many would have liked to see in this bill. The fact is that we're spending more, far more money on bailout than we are on stimulus. But and we won't know until maybe 6 months, as we see begin to see things turn around, whether or not it's hit the right balance.
You mentioned the stimulus versus the bailout. I was going to ask you how this current stimulus package dovetails, if at all, with the release of the remaining TARP funds.
It really is. They're two different situations altogether. I mean, the banks could be more helpful, and we have not heard, again, from the Federal Reserve, but the banks could be more helpful in releasing some of the dollars they have. The fact is that the banks have money that they're sitting on. The federal government has given the banks money. The banks refuse to spend it. It's ridiculous. And some of the dollars, as they release the second bit of money, the $350 billion, I shouldn't say bit, the second barrel of money, as they release that second amount of money, we really would like to see some strings put on that. Do not line up for this money if you're just going to sit on it to make yourself feel good. The purpose of that bailout money is to get some money out in the community in terms of home loans and other kinds of loans.
The plan has preserved the president's signature tax cut, a break for millions of lower and middle income taxpayers. We know that this has been very important to the Obama administration, but my question is it more a nod to the political reality or the economic reality facing Mr. Obama?
I think it's both. I think that he put that out there, as you recall, during the campaign. McCain was quick to talk about he was going to spend your money, and he came back and said, no, we will cut taxes, and so he's done that. So he had to, because he said he was. If this package passed without one of his promises, one of his key promises, I think that the public would have every right to be somewhat disillusioned. But it's an economic reality, and it's a political reality. The Republicans can go back and say, we brought you something back. You know, Republicans tend to be the ones who want to cut taxes. Barack Obama nodded to their side during the campaign, and he's kept his word.
There is disagreement, is there not, even among economists, as to whether or not a tax cut or a spending plan is the best way to quickly stimulate the economy?
There is significant disagreement, both from a partisan perspective. Democrats tend to want to spend the money, get it out there. Republicans tend to want to let you spend your own money. So if you get a tax cut, the thinking is that you will stimulate, but you may or may not. You may choose to save. You may do something else with it. But economists also disagree, although I must say that most progressive economists particularly believe that spending makes more sense and has a more immediate impact than a tax cut.
A progressive economist being what?
Those who I would say are focus on economic justice issues tend to be, you know, somewhat more left of center than right of center. That would be that group.
Now, infrastructure has been one of the cornerstones of this plan, Dr. Malvo, since the beginning. As it stands, we are looking at $100 billion for shoring up levees, repairing roads and bridges, et cetera. The president says this will create 400,000 jobs immediately. So the question, obviously, then is how realistic is that, and how immediately are people going to be able to feel this?
It's realistic that people can get back to work, I would say, within 3 months. You have some projects, the shovel-ready projects. I mean, they're projects that merely need the people in order to implement them. So the legislation will be passed, I'm sure, this week. You know, as they write it, the actual bill will be filed. And then the difficulty comes as money is put into state and local governments. How quickly can people turn it around? But we know that there are millions of people, 4 million to be exact, who lost their jobs, you know, in the last 15 months. And in addition, you have people who are constantly entering the labor market who are looking for work. And those people are going to put pressure on their legislators. Let's not have some convoluted process that makes it take 6 months before these projects are approved. The purpose in approving shovel-ready projects is that they could be implemented immediately. Now, immediately is not tomorrow. But I would say that within 3 months, we ought to see a bump in the number of people who are working, and it ought to be, you know, a large bump.
We're talking about enormous amounts of money between the stimulus package and the bailout. Under normal circumstances, I suppose, Dr. Malvo, one would expect that it would take a certain amount of time to be able to cobble together a plan that would be effective and have some economic veracity to it. We didn't have that time because of the dire consequences. So are we getting the best we could get given the time that we had?
You know, I the question, Tony, is what do we want? Do we want to fine-tune the bill so that we ended up with a perfect bill, or do we want to get the money out there really soon? I don't think this bill is perfect by anybody's imagination. There are a list of things that HBCU presidents have been lobbying for, which are just not there at all. We ask for more money for the Pell. We ask for relief for students in terms of student loans to be able to pay those back later. We ask for more grant money for colleges, and that just didn't happen. You know, we're going to have to come back and get another bite of the apple. As disappointed as I am at not getting what we wanted, what buoys me is the notion that families, that people who lost their jobs, Tony, don't have time to wait. People who are sitting on the verge of foreclosure and don't have a paycheck don't have time to wait. So it usually takes a very long time to get the perfect bill, and then even then it's not perfect. I think that to move on the part of expediency, it's a great beginning for President Obama, and we'll tweak it and do more later.
I guess we'll also have to wait to see how the stock market reacts to the news. That should be a bellwether of some importance, I would suspect.
Well, the stock market tanked yesterday. It was down by more than 300 points on the news that the stimulus bill, you know, as they were getting closer to agreement. We'll see what happens today. But the market, let's be clear about what the stock market is doing. Part of what's happening.
Well, let me stop you only because I think your answer is going to take longer than we have time for. So
okay.
We'll have to say that when we bring you back on Monday. Dr. Malveaux, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony. Always a pleasure.
That was author and economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She is also the president of Bennett College. Now, we just heard a breakdown of the president's economic team, so now we're going to look at what that team has to do to keep this economy afloat. With us, we have Jackie Calmes, national correspondent for The New York Times. Jackie, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Now, life on the campaign trail and life in the White House can be very different experiences for a president, Jackie. So first, they make a lot of promises, then they have to follow through. What changes in terms of economic policy have we seen in the president's evolution from Obama the candidate to Obama the president? And in fact, there's an analysis of this very point in the New York Times today, isn't there?
Yes, there is. I mean, when he was a candidate, this economic stimulus package that is going to be coming to his desk by early next week will include a reflection of a lot of his campaign platform. A middle-class tax cut, some down payments on programs that have to do with encouraging energy conservation and alternative energy sources, education, and some initiatives to cut health care costs, mainly the money for encouraging doctors and hospitals to move towards information technology instead of just this paper world they work in now that causes extra costs. So, but the main thing that's happened between November and now is that he's had to ratchet up the size of his economic program almost by the week as the economy got so much worse. And in the process, you know, this will be a big victory for him, but at the same time, it underscores how much of his presidency is going to be dominated by trying to help the economy, and some of his bolder initiatives may have to be put on the shelf.
You know, President Bill Clinton made a lot of promises that he wasn't able to fulfill. It ultimately caused the Democrats to lose control of Congress. What specifically can President Obama do to avoid the same kinds of pitfalls?
Well, he did one thing that's incorporated into this economic recovery plan package. Throughout the evolution of this package, he insisted that it include his proposed tax cut called Making Work Pay tax credit that was supposed to be $500 for low-wage and middle-class individuals and $1,000 for couples. You could either be as a lump sum or it could be through adjusting the tax tables so that your weekly or biweekly paycheck is a little bit bigger. And there was, you know, there was not a lot of enthusiasm for it either among Democrats or Republicans, but he was remembering that one of the big raps against Bill Clinton was that in 1993 he took office having promised a middle-class tax cut and never came through with it. And as president, his focus turned to bringing down the deficits, and so there was a small tax increase for most Americans, a gas tax increase, and then a bigger tax increase for richer Americans, though he had promised that. But the bottom line is Barack Obama was determined that he was not going to do like Bill Clinton and be vulnerable to the charge that he had promised a middle-class tax cut and did not deliver.
I don't know how long people's memories are about that, Jackie, and I raise that because it seems that most people seem to have understood that President Obama inherited this economic crisis, and yet there is a question as to how long they will allow him to enjoy the good feeling of support before they
right.
turn on him if things don't turn in the economy quickly.
Well, that's right. You know, hemming and hawing about this package, all will be forgotten. What people will remember is whether or not they felt like it worked. I think, you know, all the polls suggest now that the people really know that he did inherit this. He bears no blame for it, and it's a, you know, nobody really knows what to do. They're just sort of experimenting, much as Franklin Roosevelt did, you know, 70 years ago. But I think that he definitely has to be seen as competent. And that was a big rap against George Bush, that over time people, the overwhelming majority of Americans, just thought he was had proven incompetent in handling the economy.
My final thing is this, and I appreciate your coming on. One of the cornerstones of the president, then-candidate Obama's approach to the people was that he would reach across the aisle. And there have been questions as to whether he really reached across the aisle effectively as far as the stimulus is concerned. Fair or unfair?
I think he was effective. I'm not sure he ever could have expected to win a lot of people over, but he had to be seen as trying a budget. After all, like the stimulus economic recovery plan is actually a budget measure. It incorporates the priorities of the majority party, and the Republicans and Democrats have very different ideas of how to handle spending and taxes. So he was never going to get a lot of votes, but he tried, and he clearly tried not just stylistically but substantively. And what your listeners have to remember is there are very few moderate Republicans left in Congress. There's very few people left to deal with because Democrats have been so successful at the polls for the last two cycles.
I've got about 15 seconds for this. Would you say that this president, is under more public scrutiny than either of his recent predecessors?
Well, any president's under scrutiny, but I think yes. I mean, he's a groundbreaker. He's the first African-American president. That alone will bring him more scrutiny.
Jackie, thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Jackie Combs is a national correspondent for The New York Times. And Thursday is a day for a look at the weekend sports, and baseball takes the headlines on the eve of the opening of spring training.
I did take a banned substance, and, you know, for that, I'm very sorry and deeply regretful.
That's New York Yankees superstar slugger Alex Rodriguez. He is the first topic on today's Sports Bloggers Roundtable. Joining us now, Chad Brown. He writes for Alpha Blog Sports, and Greg Lee, the online sports editor for the Boston Globe. Hey, fellas.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank
How's
you
it
very
going?
Much.
Good.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad you guys could be with us. Here we have this squeaky clean Alex Rodriguez, who has practically been the face of Major League Baseball, admitting taking steroids. Chad, in fact, before I get you to respond, let me say this. President Obama was asked about his reaction to the A-Rod news, and the president called the episode depressing, saying it tarnishes an entire era to some degree. This happened at the first primetime press conference of the President of the United States.
Our kids hopefully are watching and saying, you know what, there are no shortcuts. That when you try to take shortcuts, you may end up tarnishing your entire career, and that your integrity is not worth it. That's the message I hope is communicated.
So, Chad, you're in New York. I imagine everybody in New York City is talking about this.
Oh, yeah. It's been all over the papers, all over the TV, everywhere. I heard about it Saturday, and just I didn't know whether or not to believe it or what my response would be. A lot of my friends say they're through with baseball, although we'll see what happens when opening day. But really, it seems to be a split. There are some fans that really don't care and just want the Yankees to win this season. There are others who are non-A-Rod fans who are kind of using this to open up the floodgates of criticism. And there are others who liked him before, but after hearing this, don't really know, even though none of this happened during his Yankees tenure. It's really a shame. It's really a shame.
Well, you know, go ahead, Greg, let me bring you in, because even just today in the USA Today, a column by Christine Brennan, she interviewed the baseball commissioner, Bud Selig, and he's talking about trying to suspend A-Rod.
Well, Bud Selig, his commissioner, has always been, in my opinion, one who goes with the wind. He should have, if he really wanted to attack, penalize these players, which he cannot do now based on that collective bargaining agreement, he should have done that a few years ago. He should have done that with Barry Bonds' chase for his friend Hank Aaron's home run record. So right now, it's basically, I see Bud Selig is looking at popular opinion right now, and he's hearing what's going on with A-Rod. So now he wants to act like he's a commissioner and wants to do something, and it's too late.
Not only is he talking about potentially suspending A-Rod, he's talking about going into the Hall of Fame and putting asterisks behind names of everybody who was playing during that time whose numbers could be brought up in a question, Chad.
Yeah, I really don't know what to make about that. I'm guessing if any more names come out, it would be appropriate to go wholesale on this. But I don't know, with A-Rod, you might want to look at what he does from here on out, but you have to judge the whole body of work. So I don't know, it would have to probably be on a case-by-case basis, but I could definitely see that happening, whether or not I agree with it.
You know, it's an interesting thing because, you know, we saw A-Rod on 60 Minutes with a straight face deny, just lie, and said that he had not taken steroids. And then we saw him in the interview with ESPN just a couple of days ago saying again with a straight face that he had. I don't know whether the public believes him or not this time, or whether they believe that he did it unknowingly, and whether or not they're going to hold him accountable. Do you think the public is angry, Chad? Really briefly, because we got to go to a break.
Yeah, I think they are. I would think they are. That's as brief as I can put it.
Well, that'll work. I tell you what, we're going to continue this conversation. We're going to talk more about A-Rod. We're also going to talk about Miguel Tejada. Here's the only person who has admitted taking steroids and who has admitted lying before a congressional committee. Now, his hot water may be hotter than the hot water that someone like A-Rod finds himself in. So stick around. We're going to come back and talk about that in just a minute. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We're back now with our sports bloggers. With us, Chad Brown, who writes for Alpha Blog Sports, and Greg Lee, the online sports editor for the Boston Globe. Guys, we're talking about steroids in baseball and A-Rod. One of the things, Chad, that came out of this week was that A-Rod's name was on a list of 104 players who tested anonymously, so they thought at the time, for steroid use in baseball in 2003, the point being that baseball was trying to see how rampant the use of steroids was at that time, and the next year they would come in, which they did, with a policy banning it. Now we have these other names, 103, that have not been released. What's your opinion about whether or not those names should be protected or disclosed?
I think it depends on when they were doing it and how relevant it is to what their performance now. But I would say release them, because in this day and age, that list is not going to remain confidential for much longer. So is it better to have a wholesale release or have it come out piece by piece and have the league have to confirm or deny it?
Well, you know, Greg, some players, I heard Torrey Hunter say this on the radio just the other day. Torrey Hunter is now with the Angels, was with the Minnesota Twins, and he and A-Rod were teammates when they were 16 years old on some national team. And the point that he made was this: someone had it in personally for A-Rod because A-Rod's name was the only one of these 104 that was released, and that the 103 others on that list are probably shaking in their boots.
Yeah, I could see that. And really, in terms of the case of A-Rod, perhaps that person who released it is probably a Yankees fan. And you know how some Yankees fans are, is that it's a privilege to wear the pinstripes, and he's making $252 million, and he hasn't produced a thing for us. And not only he's gotten traded to the Yankees, he also got a second contract out of the Yankees when he became a free agent last year. So, and he's been kind of fraudulent. So, yeah, I could see some truth to what Torrey is saying in terms of the hateration of A-Rod.
One more thing about this before we move on, Chad, and that is, spring training begins this weekend, and I'm sure people in baseball had hoped that once the Barry Bonds situation was settled that they could move on past this. Now it appears as if this is going to carry, you know, who knows how long into the coming season.
No, you're absolutely right. I think it's going to hang over the league's head during spring training, and I think it's only going to be – and I don't think it'll go away once the season starts, but I think you just have to ride with it. It's not going anywhere. It's going to be analyzed. Everybody's going to be scrutinized. You just it's not going away.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk about football. Somebody who is going away, or is he going away? Brett Favre, the future Hall of Fame quarterback from Green Bay, spent the last season with the New York Jets, 18 record-breaking seasons, one Super Bowl championship. I don't know, Greg. I'm going to ask you first. I know Chad's in New York, but we're going to go outside of New York City first to see what you make of this decision. He says he's not coming back. I kind of believe him. Why would he?
I think he's done. I think mentally he's done. And in reality, even over the last three or four years, even go back to his days with the Packers, his last day with the Packers, he brought a kind of a soap opera about him that is really tarnishing his, I think, his legacy. I know with a lot of people are saying that Brett Favre, just make up your mind and just go away, or just play, just quit making it about yourself. And I think now he realizes that he's done. And I really think that he's going to sit back in Kill, Mississippi, and do his thing down there with his family and hunt and do what he does in Mississippi.
I guess there's something about being a quarterback of the Jets, Chad, that it's just hard to give up. I'm thinking about Broadway Joe Namath, who left and went and played with the Rams, I think it was, the last year or two of his career, ended on a whimper, you might say. Mm-hmm. And this is similar for Brett Favre, isn't it?
No, it absolutely is. I mean, I listened to the press conference yesterday, and I really heard a man who was at peace with his decision. It wasn't like last year with all the tears and everything, which he was entitled to, or as Greg said, the will he won't he saga. I mean, when he got traded to the Jets, I had a lot of my friends who in Wisconsin saying, "Good luck, you're going to get a lot of good, but you're going to get a lot of bad," which is really the best way to summarize that situation. But I think it wasn't a total wash in being here, but I will always remember Brett Favre as a Green Bay Packer. I always will. I'm not going to completely forget this year because it definitely had its ups and a big time down at the end.
Oh, man, for sure. Woody Johnson said he's the owner of the Jets, said in a statement released by the team that considering that Favre came from a totally different environment and joined our team during training camp, his performance last season was, in the words of Woody Johnson, extraordinary. And I suppose, Chad, you would have to say the first half of the season was extraordinary, maybe good, and the second half was extraordinarily bad.
That's the perfect way to put it, perfect or imperfect. I mean, I'll remember the games against when he brought him back against New England and the outstanding performance against the Titans. I mean, heck, he even blittered the NFC champion Cardinals for 6 touchdown passes, which he had never done before. So there were definitely some ups, definitely some downs, but it really ended on a downer, especially when the guy that you released came back in and virtually knocked the Jets out of the playoffs.
Well, let's one more football note before we go on to another topic, and this is something, Chad, I think you've been writing about. The Cardinals, you mentioned them, their wide receiver Anquan Boldin, not happy with his contract. What's up with that, briefly?
What's up with that is he says he would come back for the players and for the coaches, but not for the organization, and because he feels that they betrayed him. And he said he was putting that all on hold during the Super Bowl run. But it seems like the Cardinals are undergoing a lot of change with Haley going to the Chiefs. Did Lewis, the defensive coordinator, Warner doesn't know if he's coming back. They need to hold on to him.
All right, now one other football note up in your area, Greg. What about Matt Castle? Where is he going to be?
Well, the Patriots, they're holding the ball. They really want to see what's the market out there for Matt Castle, and also keep him as an insurance just in case Tom Brady won't be able to make it back from perhaps the beginning of the season and hold on to Castle. But at the same time, if they do keep Castle, it's $29 million tied into two players at the same position, and that's not the Patriots' way. So I think they're giving themselves some time to look at the market and see if they can get a first and third round pick, maybe a first and a second round pick. But they could deal, or they could just sit tight and see, making sure that Tom Brady's ready to go next year.
All right, let's talk about basketball for a moment. And before we get to the NBA All-Star game that's coming up, here's a story that really is still developing here in Los Angeles involving NBA Hall of Famer Elgin Baylor, who was with the Lakers all those years, but for the last 2 decades has been in the front office of the woeful Los Angeles Clippers. And now he is suing them. Claiming that they had racist attitudes toward players and that they mistreated him, and there's some disagreement, I suppose would be an understatement to say, over his compensation in terms of how he left. This is sort of a sad thing to hear, isn't it, Chad?
It absolutely is. You're talking about a guy named Elgin Baylor who really gave his heart and soul to the Clippers, a floundering team with the exception of probably the 2006 season where they ended up going to, the playoffs almost to the Western Conference Finals. But it's a shame. There's no other way to know about it. I just heard about it this afternoon, but it doesn't sound good.
Well, one of the things that the Clipper organization says, well, look, you know, we had a losing team for 22 years, and we kept him. So that ought to say something about whether or not we were discriminatory, Greg.
Well, I would say this. If he was being the one thing that he should understand, he worked with Donald Sterling, who for years had made a lot of money being cheap with the Clippers. He didn't care about the product that was out there. And one of the things about his products that was cheap was his GM. He paying his GM $350,000. And if Elgin Baylor thought that he was being mistreated, well, I would have left after 10 years or 15 years because a lot of his colleagues are making way more than $350,000. So if he was really, you know, feeling that bad about it, but he should have left. At the same time, he should also realize who his owner is, Donald Sterling.
True.
So
that's true.
So
that's
if
true.
He runs a cheap franchise, you're cheap labor too.
Well, I guess you got a point there. Speaking of people being unhappy, there are a lot of people in the NBA right now who feel that they should be in Phoenix, Arizona, playing in that game on Sunday, and they are not going to be there because they were not selected, not elected by the fans, nor selected by the coaches to be on the team. What do you think of this, Chad? Who's the angriest and who has the best case?
That's
tough, huh?
It is. It's very tough. It's very tough. Greg, you want to take a shot at this?
Well, one thing that, until a couple of injuries happened, the biggest problem was the Cleveland Cavaliers until a couple of days ago only had one representative, and they have one of the best records in the league this year. They only had until 2 days ago LeBron James representing the Cavaliers, and now they had Mo Williams, but before it was only him, and then the Orlando Magic, who was just really coming up this year, got three candidates on there. But then there's Danny Granger, who was selected on the team ahead of Mo Williams, who is having an excellent season, averaging over 25 points a game. But the problem is he's on a losing team. So there's always going to be snubs in any type of all-star selection, you know, football, baseball, basketball. And, you know, Carmelo Anthony's not even in the all-star game. He was hurt for, you know, about 10 games. But at the same time, he's been playing at an all-star level with Chauncey Billups being there. So there's always going to be players who should have gotten there, but there's only so many spots.
Absolutely. And now something else that we'll see this week. You know, I don't know if this story is just going to keep going on all the time, all the time, all the time, but it appears that it may, and that is Shaq and Kobe. They're going to be together on the All-Star team. You know, I don't know that people really give a you-know-what about that anymore, but it's a storyline, isn't it? Isn't it?
Possibly. It possibly is. I mean, they're together. Shaq says, you know, all that was just drama manufactured. And my line of thinking is, okay, Shaq, wake me up when you win a champ, when you win another title. I think Kobe and the Lakers look like they're on the way to do it. And I'm like, Shaq, you know, you're doing well down in Phoenix, but let's see if you and Nash can get along on the court.
So. I guarantee you, I don't even know which network is doing the game, but I guarantee you there is going to be a Kobe sitting down and Shaq sitting down talking about playing together and how all of that was just whatever it was, and they're moving forward. And Kobe's the greatest player I ever played with, and Shaq, oh, he was a great guy, and you know what that's like.
Yeah, I mean, Shaq, you know, Kobe does really recognize that. Shaq helped him to get three titles, and Shaq got another title on his own without Kobe. But at the end of the day, both of them realized that they missed out on an opportunity to do something special. And, you know, when you're a little bit younger, you're a little bit immature, and then when you get older and wiser, you reflect on things that could have happened. So that's what is the bottom line, what it is right now, is that they're reflecting that they could have had six or seven titles in them if they would have stayed together.
Now, but even with all that bickering, three straight championships is nothing to sneeze at.
No, it's nothing to sneeze at all. And Kobe, he's dying to have another championship, which he'd like to have without Shaq, just to show that he was right with what he was saying before. We'll have to see. I don't know if that's going to happen this season or not.
I don't know.
You don't know? I thought you would have something to say about that, Greg. You're up in Boston.
Hey, it's going to be tough. I mean, the Lakers had to beat the Celtics twice this year, but it was two different types of circumstances. You know, the first time in L.A., the Celtics came in tired. The last game last week, Kevin Garnett came off of the flu, and he fouled out with 6 minutes left. So
and they still almost won the game.
And it's still almost won a game, and Andrew Bynum is out. So I still think that when it comes to playoff time, when the chips are really down, I still don't see the I don't see the toughness in the Lakers to win a championship yet.
That's why I love having you on, a true Boston Celtics fan. We'll talk again in June. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Chad Brown writes for Alpha Blog Sports. He joined us from our studios in New York. And Greg Lee is the online sports editor for the Boston Globe. He comes to us from WGBH in Boston. And now it's letter time. Our producer, Joanne Griffith, is here with me. Hey, Joanne.
Hey, Tony.
So a mixed bag on the letter front this week, I understand, starting with responses to a piece we covered yesterday on the alleged altercation between performers Chris Brown and his girlfriend Rihanna. Some people not too happy with comments made by our guest, Marvette Brito.
Yes, that's right. Starting with Monaka Chanduka on our website, she writes, Ms. Brito's positive assertion that Rihanna would not press charges because she was in a relationship for well over a year made me queasy. The victim's right to press charges should not be trivialized as a simple career albatross.
Mira Sanchez from Monroe, Michigan added her thoughts via email. She says, Rihanna should press charges to show the world that you can't back down once the bruises heal and the swelling goes down. Shame on Marvette Brito for putting public image before standing up for yourself and what is right. Of course, we'll continue to cover this story as it develops on News & Notes.
Now, last Friday, we looked at President Obama's effect on the media and what this means for black journalists working in mainstream news organizations and on specialist publications. Laura Henning from Georgia says color is irrelevant when covering presidential affairs. She writes, I think you're forgetting how reporters become White House reporters. You need to have an outlet that puts a reporter in the press room, and you need to have the contacts that would allow you to be hired as said reporter. If you don't have people to confirm or respond to a story, the color of your skin is not going to make a difference.
And staying with the White House, how to address the new president continues to get folks hot under the collar this week and caused a stir on our bloggers' roundtable yesterday. Here's Kevin Ross.
This whole point about Barack's name, the president's name, right now, it doesn't matter what you call him. Folks are hurting and they need jobs. And if we're not able to address that on a level that people can relate to, they're going to be calling him more than just what we're referring to right now.
But some of our listeners just don't agree. Barry Hoffman is one of them. He writes, I keep hearing President Obama referred to as Mr. Obama on your broadcasts. I think that this is very disrespectful and wish you would correct it. Likewise, Sue Fitzsimmons from Greensboro, North Carolina, notes, the inauguration is over. He should be referred to by the title President.
Well, just to clarify, it is NPR's policy to address the president as President Obama when he is first mentioned in a piece. After that, he is called Mr. Obama. This is how all previous presidents have been addressed on national public radio in the past.
Now, Tony, before we go, some love for you and the show. Detwan Williams from New York writes, I think it's unbelievable in an age where we have an African-American elected to the White House that we're losing black media. Valeria Jones from Athens, Georgia, says she's sad to see the end of News & Notes next month. She writes, my friends and I, both black and white, listen to the show and it helps me to understand what's happening in the world. And Paul Barnes from Bensalem, Pennsylvania, captures it all in the title of his email, Tony Cox Rules.
Ah, very nice. Thank you very much. I'm humbled. Well, that's it for letters. Please keep your thoughts coming over the next few weeks. And to write us, just log on to npr.org and click Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Be sure to click on News & Notes when you write to us.
And do tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Joanne, thank you very much.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News & Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, President Obama took office with a war on two fronts and an explosive conflict in the Middle East. We'll take a closer look at the Obama administration's emerging foreign policy.